This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, November 18th, 2011. I'm Caleb Brown. The super committee charged with making some small spending cuts appears unable to achieve even that tiny task. I spoke with Cato Institute Senior Fellow Alan Reynolds at the Cato Institute's 29th Annual Monetary Conference earlier this week. We're about a week out from Congress's delegated committee, the so-called super committee, trying to come up with some sort of budget deal, and they're making quote-unquote cuts, but nothing seems to have emerged.
It's really quite remarkable, first of all, that Congress delegated that job. It's their job to a so-called super committee, that the super committee finds this a major challenge. I mean, the government spending, federal spending, increased by 6 percentage points from the average of the period, from the period from 1997 to 2007. Federal spending was a little over 19% of GDP. It jumps up to more than 25% of GDP during the fiscal stimulus fiasco of 2009. And yet here we are in 2011, and it's still above 24. It's only dropped 1 point. So the temporary expenditures seem to be like entrenched and permanent. And the problem is of an order of magnitude much larger than anything they're trying to do here. We're talking about spending of $3.6 trillion, and they say, well, we're going to take out $1.2 trillion, but of course that means over 10 years. That's $120 billion a year out of a $3.6 trillion budget. I mean, this is really peanuts. And so when they begin to approach this problem, the first rumor we heard out of the committee was that the Democrats were prepared to solve this so-called $1.2 trillion problem. But first of all, they'd like to raise taxes by $1.3 trillion. That seems like a non-starter because they're not approaching spending at all. It's an entirely different thing to try to raise taxes, which turns out to be quite difficult to do, than it is to cut spending. Cutting spending frees up resources for the private sector. If you're cutting purchases, if you're cutting transfer payments, that actually incentivizes the economy. Transfer payments are a payment for not doing something, for not working, not planting crops, not saving for retirement. And so they're really kind of a negative. They're a necessary evil, perhaps, but 2 years of unemployment benefits, for example, clearly raise the unemployment rate by a percentage point or more. So cutting these things by such a small magnitude just shouldn't be a problem. And the problem with starting with saying, well, let's do taxes first, is, number one, that effort has almost always failed. It failed in 1990. Revenues went down, not up. Spending went up, not down. And the economy slipped immediately. This was the famous Read My Lips deal of the elder President Bush. The economy, coincidentally or not, slipped into recession as they were talking about this, not even when they enacted it, and it didn't, and it grew at 2.5% rate for 5 years. Very poor. It had grown at 4 for the previous 8 or 9 years. So it didn't improve growth, it didn't lower spending, and it didn't, particularly non-defense spending. Defense was being scaled back fast, and it didn't raise revenue either. So that should be the lesson. Don't do that. We have a serious spending problem. And I'm not a budget hawk by most people's standards. But when you're talking about well over $1 trillion deficits, for far as the eye can see, something's got to go. And something is spending, because that's where the problem arises. There have been some frivolous tax cuts, too. The president's making work tax credit was pretty frivolous. The temporary payroll tax cut, sweet as that may be, doesn't affect behavior because people know it's temporary. It just loses a lot of revenue. And yet there's no effort to do anything of any substance or any duration. And on the spending side, the talk is about the usual frivolous, nebulous, probably not true cuts, such as cutting Medicare payments to providers, to doctors and hospitals. They always talk about that. It never happens. If it did happen, Medicare would collapse even faster than it's collapsing.
The alternative to this group coming up with something is the so-called sequester, which will impose certain levels of spending on programs that are lower than they otherwise would be.
Yes, and of course, spending continues to grow. It's that old baseline story. My point is the baseline's very high after the growth of 2009, 10, and 11. So we take that as a baseline, and we assume that it grows at a certain rate, and all we're trying to do is slow the growth a little. What is the problem with sequester? Primarily, that it's so heavily on the defense side. Now, I think there's certainly savings can be made in military outlays. Stop having so many wars is one way. The defense is not 50% of the budget, so to impose 50% of the cuts there seems a little heavy-handed and arbitrary. But if that's the best they can do, I'd say go ahead and do it. And people talk about a credible long-term budget plan. Nothing is credible if nothing is done. It's you can't just put something out there on a piece of paper and say one of these days we're going to tackle this problem. You can do that to some extent with entitlements. You can say we're going to change the indexing, we're going to change the age. You can do that to some extent with these future commitments. But the problems we're dealing with aren't just future, they're here and now.
We're here at a monetary conference, and Jerry O'Driscoll makes the point, as we observe what's going on in Eurozone countries, his argument is essentially monetary reform first, and that there's a lot of enabling that is impossible, would be impossible with sound money.
Tom Sargent got the Nobel Prize for economics, always made that point. At a 1980 conference at the Atlanta Fed, he followed me, and I was making a case for gold, and at a time it was particularly difficult. It's now I'm finding more and more people saying, that sounds like a good idea. As I've often said, people never leave the gold standard. Only governments leave the gold standard. And it's a big vote of no confidence when the price of gold and silver do what they've done in the past couple of years in all of the central banks. Monetary system that doesn't allow the Fed, for example, to do what it did, which is to buy something like 38% of the added debt in the past couple of years. People think the Chinese are buying it. Hello, the Fed's buying a lot of it, and they're putting pressure on the commercial banks to buy lots more because, after all, we all know sovereign debt has no risk, right? Well, maybe not. But anyway, they're buying a lot too. Under a gold standard, you ultimately have to fork over the dough. If you're printing money to cover the government's debts, and people convert that money into currency and walk up and say, please give me whatever it is. When I graduated junior high school, somebody gave me a treasury silver certificate for $1, a very generous gift in the 50s. And up until 1968, I could have and probably should have converted it into a silver dollar. That was a kind of a constraint. It was one of the last remaining constraints, domestic constraints, other than Bretton Woods, on note issue. And if the currency is defined and guaranteed in terms of something of generally accepted value, such as gold or silver, you notice I'm wearing gold and silver. I'm bimetallic ring today. There are definite constraints on what you can do with fiscal policy. If that's the only way we can control it, maybe that's one of many good reasons why we ought to do it.
Alan Reynolds is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. You can read more of his work at cato.org.